Hey, ghoul friends, it's me, Adrian, or Aiden. Either way, you are still listening to Susto, the podcast of Ookie Spooky Scary Stories. Y'all, it is the first week of Halloween season of October. I love this month so much for so many reasons. It just makes me feel so good. You know, I'm glowing, my skin is moisturized, my credit score went up, I'm out of debt, my car is paid. I'm kidding, I wish all those things were true, but at least it is the season. It's spooky season. I love this month so much. I can honestly just go on and on about how much I love the month of October. I really love all holidays, but you know, this is really my time to shine. So before we get into anything today, as always, make sure to follow the Instagram for any and all updates on the show at Susto Podcast. You can also, special announcement, now follow the show on Facebook, also at Susto Podcast. Well, you just search Susto Podcast on Facebook. There's a page now, and I want you all to think of that as maybe an opportunity to interact with other people that are into this sort of stuff, and also as a place where you can share your stories with each other and with me, and I'll go through them if they're on there. And I can share them on the show as well. So if you do want to share your story with me, if you want me to read it on the show, we have three different ways now. First way, you can leave a 5-star review on iTunes and leave your story in the review. You can email the story to me to sustopodcast@gmail.com, or now you can leave it on the Susto Podcast Facebook. Please, please, please share your stories, share your pictures, share your videos, share your EVPs. I want to see and hear it all. I live for this stuff, and I know that you do too. So please share it with me, you know, share the wealth, share the spook. So yeah, with that being said, we'll jump into today's show. As you can see, we have a special guest, and that is David Bowles. David Bowles is a Mexican-American author from here, South Texas. He teaches at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He's written several books, and I really, really love his work. I own two of his books, and of course, they're on beat with what we're about here. The two books that I own and a lot of his other work are about folklore and border lore, and definitely spooky and creepy stuff. And he does a really beautiful job of not only writing about these things, but talking about them. He was an amazing guest, and I hope you all enjoy the show today. So stick around, and I'll talk to you after. Dr. David Bowles, thank you for being here.
Hey, no, it's a delight. I'm happy to.
I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, I mean, it's my favorite month, and I'm already thinking of like the things that I want to do. I'm booked out the wazoo because October comes around, and everybody's like, scary stuff? Wait a minute, David Bowles. How did I say we?
Yeah.
They know that I'm the guy to go to for the scary stuff. We need cuckoos. Let's call up Bowles.
So the scary guy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are worse things to be known about.
Like, true.
Being an expert in cuckoos is a nice thing to have on one's resume, so I'm happy to do it. And I mean, I grew up loving scary stories that come from a Mexican-American household in which this is part of the coming into the world, like this rite of passage that you go through. But frankly, it kind of starts when you're like really young. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was a baby and, you know, I came home from the hospital, there was my grandmother Garza waiting to, you know, take me in her arms and sing the very first lullaby that I would ever hear to me, right? You know, duérmete, mi niño, duérmete, mi ya, porque viene el cucu y te comerá. And you're like, hang on.
Pause, time out. I just got here.
You're telling me that if I don't go to sleep when you tell me to, like a monster is going to come and eat me? And so, you know, you're initiated into those mm-hmm. scary things at an early age. And not, of course, not to say that all Mexican-American families are that way, because some are like super protective of their kids and don't expose them to scary stories. But no, I came from one of those hardcore Mexican-American families where it's like, from the very beginning.
Fear.
Yeah, fear. The world is a scary place. Y más te vale saberlo. And then, you know, and then when you get out there, you'll be ready for the stuff. You're expecting lechuzas and cucuyas and stuff like that.
So exactly.
When people act like evil jerks, you're kind of like, whatever. I'm like, you know,
this is a human being. This I'm is scared a human of being. Greater things.
There are witches and shapeshifters that I got to worry about, buddy.
Exactly. So then would you say that, I guess, your path to being a cucuy expert, as you put it, it was something that happened naturally, or was there maybe like one or two like instances that made you think like, this is what I want to like share with the world, or this is what I want to write about?
Yeah, no, I think it happened organically. I don't think that it was something that I deliberately set out to do. I came to it in this kind of interesting way. So my grandmother's stories and the stories of like Manco Chocasas and all these, you know, you go out on the ranch and the stories of Nahuales stealing cattle and things like that. All these stories that I heard growing up kind of pushed me in the direction of wanting to read because I wanted more stories and I was an irritating little kid. And my grandmother was like, look, I'm out. Se me acabaron. If you want more stories, you need to learn how to read. Mm-hmm. And then it's the kind of thing that led me into reading scary stuff or whatever. It put me on the path toward to going off to college, being the first person in my family to get like a master's and a doctorate and stuff. But along the way, as happens with a lot of Chicanos, when you decide you're going to go to college, you're like in middle school or high school, and you start believing that you've got to kind of like distance yourself from all of that. That is not going to help you in, you know, the ivory towers of academe. That you've got to kind of like, you know, study the canon. And those are all cute and sweet and add local color to your life, but they're not really important. But then I became a teacher. I was a middle school teacher at Donna ISD at AP Solis Middle School for like 8 years. I did my time, so...
Yeah,
I don't know what crime I committed at the time, but I did my time. And I guess my third year teaching, my second year at that school, that had a group of students, like after lunch, they were struggling readers. A lot of them had just been exited from like the ESL class. They were still English language learners. They struggled. Other kids just had kind of fallen behind. And the stories that were in the basal reader, in the textbook that the state gave us to use, weren't accessible to them, and I was so frustrated. I mean, they were good kids, but they just couldn't read, and it struck me that maybe I should try using these folktales that I grew up with as a way to kind of like hook them and bring them in. And this is like the mid-90s. There wasn't a whole lot of resources at the time. We've had a boom in the last 20 years in resources for Latinx kids, but there was one great book. It was called Stories That Must Not Die.
I have that book.
You've got it. So you know, I mean, that great cover with the sword on it and the spooky like lettering.
Mm-hmm.
Right across the hallway from me was the art teacher, Javier Garza, who's gone on to be, you know, an award-winning author of children's books, many of them, you know, about cuckoos and stuff like that. And we would sit together during lunch and dream about being writers, because we both wanted to be writers. And he had that. He had that book. And it was like weathered and the pages were falling out, and he's like, look, when I was a kid in the 70s, this is what got me interested in reading, and I use some of the stories in class and have students like do illustrations of it, maybe you should try it. So I photocopied the hell out of that thing. Boom, 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 boom. And you remember how there are like short little vignette, like real short stories in English and in Spanish with these creepy illustrations. Kids ate that up. They loved it so much. And it was that experience that led me to want to try my hand at doing something similar. Now, I was an English teacher. I needed to teach like all the elements of the short story and rising and falling action and da da. So I started taking my grandmother's stories and retelling them in like a kind of literary way that was accessible to kids. Mm-hmm. And I would do a couple every year. And over time, I realized that I had a book basically, and that became my first book, the Seed: Stories from the River's Edge. And it was a really, I mean, kids responded so well to that. And I got them to go out into the community and interview elders in their family and write those stories down and retell them. And it was just a really energizing experience.
Yes.
And it's what made me realize that although I wanted to write the great American novel and do all this nonsense that you think that you want to do when you're an English major, that what I was feeling a call for was to re-encounter my roots.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can go through, especially in the 70s, 80s, you can go through school and never read work by U.S. Latinx writers. So it wasn't really until I got to college and I started reading like Sandra Cisneros and Rudy Anaya and so forth. And then took a class with Dr. Mark Glazer and began to realize, in terms of anthropology and folklore, the stories and recipes and, you know, dichos and so forth of my family were things that were studied.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me like realize that rather than deprecating those things and setting them aside, I needed to elevate them and reintegrate them into my life. And that's kind of what set me on this path to, you know, because kids love scary stories and I love scary stories. It seemed like a good place to start. And then my career has blossomed from there, and I've done a lot of other things, but they're all really at the end of the day rooted in folklore and leyendas and so forth. And eventually, because those things are rooted in mythology of pre-Columbian peoples, that's where I go down, you know, that rabbit hole into studying Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs and so forth, And they have lots of really spooky, scary myths as well. So, you know, it always it comes back to this kind of cool darkness. And it's the way it's threaded through our culture and the culture of our ancestors. Mm-hmm. Which is a really long way of answering your question.
So. Yeah, no, that's okay. That's perfect. So I think one of the bigger questions that I had also, you write about these things, you keep the storytelling going, you keep the culture alive in that way. And that's one of your contributions. Do you actually believe in spirits and ghosts?
I mean, I get the question occasionally.
Yeah.
And like kids always want to know. Like if I do a school visit and I talk about these things and tell some of these stories, kids, especially younger kids, will be like, but is it true? And I say, look, you're not going to want to hear this, but it doesn't matter if they're objectively true or not. Like to me, it doesn't matter whether there really are, you know, shape-shifting witches that we call lechuzas, whatever. What matters to me is that we tell those stories, and what does it say about us? You know, why do we tell those stories? What are they about? You know, what does it say about our community and the things we believe in and things we care about? You know, why do we tell the story of La Llorona again and again and again? Like, what does it say about justice? What does it say about the need for equity for women, the need to change the way we look at gender roles and the relationship between, you know, men and women? Those are the questions I think that are really, really important. So I don't discount those things, but at the same time, I'm kind of a skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a skeptic who sees them as valuable and worthwhile. And I've had experiences that are strange and, or, you know, inexplicable or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I choose to have an open mind about them. I can't say that I've ever, like, actually, like, encountered face-to-face the spirit that I grappled with, or when they arm wrestled the chupacabras. And I can't say any of that stuff. But, you know, like anybody else, I've had strange experiences. When I was a kid, my dad, who had grown up, like, a lot of Catholics in the Valley, in this kind of, like, blended world of curanderismo, santería, and catolicismo, no?
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, he kind of really went down the santería path for a while. He was in the Navy, and he spent time in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and kind of like deepened his dabbling in dark magic, whatever. And he had like these two black cats. They were named Laverne and Shirley, which is a joke that older people would get.
Amazing. Yeah. I know, I love that.
That's Laverne and Shirley. And he got stationed in New York City, and we stayed behind. And my mom, who had started spending time with a group of women, they were charismatic Catholics. That was the organization. And there was like this like subgroup of Catholic women, and she would pray for him all the time, and she'd put like a little, I don't know, some kind of handkerchief in his duffel bag with like a Bible verse stitched into it. And when she would pray, these cats would like attack her, and so she would have to take them outside, and she would pray, and they would like be jumping on the screen of the window, like trying to get in and get at her. One time when she was praying, she locked herself up in her room to pray, and she had, you know, those like really 70s like candelabra things that you would hang on the wall, had like chains going between, yeah, like super cheesy 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And she swears, I wasn't there in the room, so I don't know, that it came flying off the wall and hit her when she was trying to pray. So weird things like that would happen. And during this time,
and this is the same place where the cats would attack her.
Yeah, same.
Wow,
yeah.
Maybe it was like the place and not so much like the cats or like...
Possibly. So my dad, in the house where we lived at the time, the den was like his study. And he had like a TV, I guess, relatively big. One of those console TVs back in the 70s, whatever. And he had like a bookshelf with his books on it, and a nice little comfy chair. And then he had like a rug on the floor. I guess it was like a converted garage is what it was. And he had a rug on the floor. And my mom had to put up like a sheet of plastic over the entrance, because even though it was summer, the room was always ridiculously cold, like super, super cold. And one day I wandered inside and I was like looking at his books, climbing up on a little stepladder with his books, and I got down. And as I was like leaving the room, I like kicked the rug, like as one will, and it kind of bunched up. And I saw like lines in the floor underneath it, and I pulled the rug back, and there was a fucking pentagram. I'm sorry, on the floor. There was there was a pentagram on the floor.
That's crazy.
And it was, yeah, it's the kind of thing that when you're, what was I, 6 years old? It was very scary.
That's interesting. Wow. Yeah. Do you remember what color it was? Was it like black? Was it burned? Was it scratched? Was it white? Like,
it was painted and it was like a dark color. So it was probably black, I would imagine. Yeah. It was kind of gloomy in the room, so I couldn't have.
Did your parents know that that was there? Or did you never ask
them? Oh, no. My dad had painted it there. So,
oh, okay.
So about a year later, my dad converted from whatever weird thing that he was into, ostensibly Catholic, but with all this like weird dark magic going on, to evangelical Christianity, and he like burned all of his rock and roll records and painted the floor, and like, so he like, but yeah, but I know for sure that he definitely had painted a pentagram on the floor. He also had brought back from Haiti a little like idol, a little statue. Of some, like, you know, orisha or something like that, made of human bone. And he would, like, whenever he wanted to, like, have a girl fall in love with him or whatever, he would take a Polaroid of her, and then he would light it on fire and set it on the, it was like a little bone altar thing.
Oh, wow.
So bizarre. And so, like, I was a child in the midst of this kind of really weird confrontation in my parents' marriage between, you know, religious belief and belief in darker supernatural powers that I think obviously like colored the way I looked at things. And for the longest time, I mean, after my dad became an evangelical Christian, then he became a minister, and then I became like really active in the church. And so up until the age of 16, when he like abandoned us, just another story. I was like really, really like gung-ho religious. You know, when you grow up with that, your reaction is there are really dark, evil things in the world. I need to be on the side of like light or whatever. Now, at almost the age of 50, my views on those kinds of things have changed considerably. But when I was a teenager, it was like, you know, very real for me. Very, you know, I could. And so when things would happen that sometimes I look back in retrospect and I go, you know, those things may have explanations that at the time my heightened sense of peril and insecurity just didn't let me see, and so I was a lot more liable to believe that those are supernatural things. Of course, other people might say, yeah, well, now you're looking back and you're trying to like cover up the real supernatural things that are going in your life. So I mean, it's kind of hard. I keep an open mind about it, but yeah, there were definitely bizarre things that happened when I was young that at the very least have, you know, led me to be interested in these things, even if I am a skeptic myself right now.
Do you have one experience that, you know, one of those things that you mentioned that had happened in the past when you're younger, do you have one that like, when, if someone asks you, like, what's the scariest thing that happened to you? Like, what's the first one that comes to mind?
Well, I mean, the scariest thing that happened to me when I was a kid laying in my bed around that same period of time, which was about 6 months to a year of like this weird stuff happening all the time. So I would have been 6 years old, laying in bed. My brother Matthew would have been in a twin bed on the other side of the room from me. This was before my brother Thomas Fernando came into the scene. In fact, he wasn't even born yet, I don't think. And so I was laying in bed. There was like, I heard a voice and it woke me up, and I was staring up at the ceiling, and there was this horrible face hovering above me. Like this, like demonic, twisted, weird thing, and it was saying my name. It was like David. Like
that. Oh God!
Oh my God! So I like jump into my brother's bed and like just like bury my face and like just as if I was six, so that means my other brother was four. Like a 4 year old is gonna be able to protect me, but there's like this sense of safety and being close to somebody.
Yeah.
And like I could like hear like the echoes of it and like this like gurgling laughter or whatever.
Like even after you got into
Yeah, even after I got to bed, like it was fading, God. But there was still like this.
Oh God.
It was so it's screwed
so
up.
Gross.
It was so, oh my God. It was definitely something that stayed with me for a long time. I can think about it right now, 44 years later, and imagine and hear what the sounds were like. More recently, when I was doing the research for Ghost of the Rio Grande Valley, one of the things that I did was I made the photographer and the illustrator, Jose Melendez and his girlfriend, go out to the majority of these sites because they needed to take pictures of them, but like at dusk as the sun's going down. And they were like, why don't you go out? And I go, you guys are young and can run fast. I don't want to like be in these haunted places and have something happen. But I did go into one place And I think a lot of people kind of sneak into it, and it's the San Juan Hotel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the San Juan Hotel, they've tried to open it like multiple times, and they keep closing it down because when they open it, people stay in those rooms, and they're like freaking ghosts everywhere. Like, it's one of the most haunted places in the valley. And so I guess the summer before we were working on the book, I went there, and it was all boarded up, and I, like, you know, trespassed and went inside. Sorry, owners of the San Juan Hotel, if you're listening, it's too late. I think the statute of limitations has run out on that.
Yeah.
and I was wandering around, and it's like, it was a mess. And there were, like, you know, it was junk on the floor and beer bottles and an old stained mattress where God knows what happens. And but I walked into one room, though. And I mean, this is summer. You know, summer's in the valley. My God, right? You know, it was like 105 degrees inside
sweltering.
That building. Yes. And I walked into a room, and the temperature dropped so fast that my skin started shaking and like little goosebumps popped out.
Oh,
right. And I was like, look, there is probably an explanation for this, but like, I'm not going to stick around and try to figure out what scientific explanation.
Yeah.
Look for the draft or whatever. I'm just going because that's scary as hell. And of course, the story about that is that when you had the events around the time of the Mexican Revolution in the first part of the 20th century, that year, 1915, that the war was dying down over there, but there were still all these incursions into the valley. The government, because they had discovered this thing called the Plan de San Diego, which was a call by some Mexican nationals to people living in the U.S. Southwest to rise up on a certain day and overthrow their white masters, you know, African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, Native Americans living in the U.S. Southwest on such and such a date, just kill every man over the age of like 14 or whatever it was. And so people were scared, even though like the plan hadn't gotten into anybody's hands. It was just this, you know, official who happened to have it with him as he crossed. And he was in McAllen. He showed it to some doctor and he was arrested. He was arrested by a deputy, Tom Mayfield, who would later be called Whispering Tom. And this guy, you know, took him into custody and word got out. And the government federalized all these state guards people and sent them to the valley. We had like 100,000 federalized National Guardsmen in the valley for the better part of a year. Because everybody was afraid that the Mexican-Americans were going to rise up. It was like the most ridiculous thing in the world. All the Mexican-Americans are like, dude, we're just trying to like...
We literally just want to chill.
We just want to chill. Yeah, leave us alone. And during that time, you had a bunch of not existing Texas Rangers who had been established or whatever, but people who got field commissions as Texas Rangers. And one of them was the same guy, Tom Mayfield. And they began... He was one of the worst ones. They began to do things like carry out summary justice. They would come across a group of Mexican-Americans that they suspected was doing something wrong, something bad had happened nearby, and they would, there on the spot, decide whether they were guilty, and they would execute them. I think 2,000 people were killed in the space of about 5 years during this time that we call La Matanza. And so one of the worst things was this thing that Tom Mayfield did to a group of Mexican-Americans in Alamo City Park, where he strung them up, hanged them, right? And then shot them and then, you know, burned them. It was like this, like, just horrible. But while people from the Alamo San Juan area were like, you know, kind of like hiding on the periphery, watching what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible, terrible thing. And so eventually the federal government like stepped in and said, okay, this is really... because it wasn't the federal government first. It was Mexico. Mexico calls up the U.S. president and they're like,
what's going on?
What are you guys doing? You can't, this is insane. You're supposed to be like a free country. And so they stepped in and they took the commission away from a lot of those guys. And Tom Mayfield was one of the ones who lost his commission. He ended up in Mexico. This is a guy who hated Mexicans. He ended up in Mexico working as like part of security for the an American petroleum company down there. And he happened to be in a bar one evening talking smack about Mexicans in a bar full of Mexicans.
Jesus.
And somebody sliced his throat. He didn't die, but it damaged his vocal cords. And so afterwards, he would talk like this. And that's why they called him Whispering Tom.
Yeah.
Well, Whispering Tom went on to become like a major member of law enforcement in the San Juan area. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, people who didn't know anything about what he did when he was a young man, like looked up to him and saw him as like, you know, there's the guy who's going to keep them Mexicans in their place and keep law and order, you know, that kind of thing, right? So he eventually, like, everybody in his life left him. Wife, he had nobody. And in his final years, he lived all the time in the San Juan Hotel. Mm. Close to where he had killed people and where people had been strung up and so forth. And what la gente say, you know, los abuelos, los ancianos, they all say that the spirits of the people that he had tortured and killed, they lingered in that place. They are still in that hotel. And they began to torment him. Mm-hmm. That's what they say. They began to torment him. And eventually it drove him, you know, ill. And he got so ill that he had to be put in the San Juan Hospital. But they followed him there. And they tortured him and tormented until he died. And this is of course, some cuentos, I don't know, but they say that the spirits dragged his spirit back to the hotel, and that's why no one can live there, because it's his place of torment. That's where he is condemned to be tormented by the souls of the people whose lives he took. That's some crazy stuff right there. But when you go there, you feel it. I mean, you just look at the picture on the back of my book. It just feels,
I'm getting, like, chills
bad
right here.
It feels like a place where you don't want to be.
Yeah, because there's definitely those places that you walk in, and as soon as you step in there, you're like, I should not be here.
I
need to turn around.
I need to get out of here because this is not a place for me. And so, you know, the question becomes, is that feeling that you get when you walk in one of those places, is it because of actual, you know, ethereal, spiritual things? Or is it because there is maybe a slightly more metaphorical or psychological scar on the collective psyche of a community? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe no one can do anything there because our collective consciousness, our collective memory, our collective will retains the pain of what was, you know, carried out, you know, the harm that was inflicted on our ancestors. You know, like I say, I'm almost 50, and I grew up, and I would hear my grandfather Manuel tell stories of, no, y luego los pinches rinches mataban a la gente. And I was a kid, like, the Rangers did not kill anybody. And he's like, ay, mijo, lo que tú no sabes.
Yeah.
There's things that you don't know. And that's another reason to tell these stories. A lot of the ghost stories in the valley are kind of connected or, you know, somehow illustrative of the horrible things that have happened.
Yeah, of the trauma.
Yeah, of the trauma.
Yeah, and that's something that I've talked about in this show before, is that, or that I mentioned, is that a lot of these stories, a lot of, like, the analogies tied to these stories are rooted in our trauma and things that we've experienced. And I feel like another big one, and I would like your input on this, is I always notice that a lot of the time, some of the stories would be like, oh, and this spirit or this entity or this creature or whatever, one of the type of people that they target are drunks or alcoholics. And it's always that, and so I've talked about in your previous episode how I feel like it's this sort of, like, maybe like a warning against, like, becoming an alcoholic. But it's like, I feel like there's better ways to, like, help people and to, like,
well, you know, and I think that a lot of that is, like, the hijacking of these stories by people with agendas or, like, adults who want children to behave a certain way.
Yeah,
there is, like, a sort of normative use of these stories, which I find appalling. The kinds of things that you'll see people do with the stories to try to get people not to behave in certain ways. The story of the devil at the disco, the devil at Ocasio's 2000, is a perfect illustration of a story that can be twisted so that you're basically saying, look, in 1979, Good Friday, which was also Friday the 13th, there was this girl, she disobeyed her parents. She went out with a boy with full intention, probably, of having sex. Oh my God. And
look, made
drinking alcohol. And look what happened. Mm-hmm. Se le apareció el diablo. He danced with her. La quemó toda y murió. I mean, and so, like, that whole notion that that these things can be punishment for behavior that goes outside of the norms of society, to me, that's dangerous. And to me, that's a hijacking of the story in a way that we could probably dispense with the stories themselves. But at the same time, there's something we can learn something from the way that our parents and grandparents and great grandparents have tried to utilize these stories to police our lives. And that says something about our identity, our cultural identity, and like what we need to do to reform that inside of the story. of the stories that we tell. Because, I mean, frankly, it's the over-policing. Like, because you could easily take the story of Bokassi 2000 and you could reinterpret it to mean when parents try to close their kids off from the normal experiences that every human being has a right to go through, falling in love, enjoying themselves, you know, finding joy and happiness and delight in the world, letting go sometimes, letting their hair down. When you try to keep people from naturally experiencing those things, then you invite evil. Then you invite bad things to come and hurt them. And so that those kinds of retellings I find really fascinating. And mm-hmm. this is one of the reasons that we're just beginning to scratch the surface. There's so much room for people to explore these stories and do new things with them, mm-hmm. And interrogate them and twist them inside and out. And that's what I'm really excited about. Some people are like, oh, we're telling the same stories. How many damn times are we going to tell the story of La Llorona? Well, I'll tell you what. Some of the most exciting things that are coming out right now are versions of La Llorona by feminist writers, by mujeres that want to, like, reclaim the Llorona story. Mm-hmm. My friend Guadalupe Garcia McCall, a great author, in her book, The Summer of the Mariposas, which I translated in Spanish as El Verano de las Mariposas, she presents to us a Llorona figure who says, essentially, how do you know that I drowned my children? Who told you that I drowned my children? My husband and the other men who found their bodies floating in the water and didn't find me, mm-hmm. and made assumptions about what had happened. But let me tell you what really happened. Now, I drowned myself because those kids slipped into the water and drowned because I was distracted by my grief over my husband's behavior. And so I felt guilt about what had happened to them, but I didn't drown my children. I fucking love my children. I'm not gonna drown my children. I love them. And in the book, you have the redemption of La Llorona, the Virgen de Guadalupe, who's also Tonantzin, towards the end of the book. Spoiler alert! basically tells her, look, you've suffered enough. You've done your penance. It wasn't your fault. You've paid this penance because you've chosen to, but I'm telling you, you were a good mother. You did what you had to do to take care of them. You weren't supported by the man you chose to love. That's on him, not on you. And I mean, that kind of stuff, those are like refreshing new ways to reevaluate the stories that we've grown up.
Yeah, definitely. Especially because in some of the tellings of La Llorona that I've heard is that she wasn't, after that, she wasn't permitted access to the afterlife. She wasn't allowed to rest until she could answer as, like, to the whereabouts of her children. And so hearing this version, this reclamation of her story is really interesting. And
and one of the things, I mean, the roots of a Llorona story are really fascinating. So my book that came out last year, Feathered Serpent, Dark Heart of Sky, Myths of Mexico, contains the myth of La Llorona that is celebrated every year in Xochimilco in the coast of Mexico City. Well, I guess it's actually in Mexico City. And they put on this, oh my God, if you ever get a chance to go down there late September, early October, it's just something I recommend checking out. They do an amazing show, like a play with music and lights like that. But the story basically is a Xochimilcan princess, a Nahua princess who, after the conquest, it is given by Cortes to one of his men, mm-hmm. one of his lieutenants, to be his wife. And she bears him children, and she's beginning to get used to the Spanish culture and learning Spanish, and, you know, maybe opening up a bit to Catholicism. All right, fine. She has sons. But then he gets called back to Spain. His family wants him to marry this aristocratic woman, and it means that he's going to have to set this indigenous woman aside. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I'm a princess, you son of a bitch. You don't get to set me aside. and when he leaves and, like, one supposedly entrust her care to one of his friends who then tries to rape her, and she kills this friend, and then she takes her children and she goes down to because Xochimilco is really famous for its canals where they would grow flowers, and Xochimilco means the place of the flower fields in Nahuatl. And she takes her kids down there and she drowns them, and she drowns herself so that she will be converted into what's called a Sowaehecatl, which is it's basically a Llorona, like a grieving spirit. It means a wind woman or a spirit woman. And she begins to walk the streets of colonial Xochimilco crying out and freaking all of the mestizos and criollos and castas out of their mind. And this is where the story starts. And there were a lot of like Aztec legends that had to do with women dying in childbirth and being turned into these avenging spirits and like that. So, I mean, that's deeply rooted in our indigenous heritage. And I think those stories, it's one of the reasons they endure, because every single time you retell them, you're like adding nuances, mm-hmm. and twisting them in new ways.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. You're one of those like very special guests that like I can ask you one question and then in that answer you answer like the next two or three questions that I had. So like I love that, because it's like I just have to give you one prompt and you can answer the rest, and like I can just sit back and listen to this. It's amazing.
Well, I have really enjoyed talking to you, and it's great. Your podcast is a wonderful thing, and
thank you.
Keep telling these stories and having these conversations, because in the first place, scary stuff is just cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, we've got Halloween and Dia de los Muertos right around the corner. Like, to me, October is like this just free for all. It's like just a lovely, wonderful time. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, it's part of our cultura too. So, like, keeping those things alive is also sacred work in a different way. So, it's fun and it's sacred. And you should feel proud of yourself for doing this kind of work.
I am. Thank you.
Welcome. Thanks a lot.
All right, well, is there anything else that I guess you want to sign off with? Maybe something that we missed or we brushed over that you want the people to hear?
Just, I mean, keep in mind that there are so many activities happening in the month of October throughout the valley. You should, you know, keep an eye out for great ghost tours. I'm going to be doing a presentation probably at the McCallum Public Library. We're still trying to figure out the date, but around Halloween, there are all kinds of this like really, really cool, creepy things going on. I always recommend to people watch some great horror movies in Spanish. Mm. Some of those great black and white ones that people kind of like forget about, like El Libro de Piedra and stuff like that. Like those older, really spooky stuff, just to like add some Latinx spice to your Halloween.
Yes, the spooky season.
And then just recommend people that they can read some scary stuff of mine if they go to my website, davidbowles.us. I'm going to have some cool projects coming out next year. I've got like a new series for kids called 13th Street, which is coming out from HarperCollins. And it's basically, the pitch is basically a Latinx Stranger Things for kids ages 5 to 10. So it's
cool.
Really, really cool, great illustrations and so forth. And I got a couple of graphic novels coming out next year, both of which are, you know, one of them is based on a Maya myth, and the other one is called Clockwork Curandera, and it's like this dark YA steampunk thing that's set in this alternate northern Mexico and southern Texas, and it's got features an army of lechuzas called the Witch Owl Parliament that's invading this country.
I'm going to read it.
Being illustrated by it's being illustrated by Raul Gonzalez, Raul III, who's just an amazing artist. So I just really, really want to keep producing. I don't write about folktales and so much and things like that so much anymore, because I've kind of moved off in mythology and then doing like fiction, but these things, we should definitely keep them alive. I just hope that people who are listening who have these kinds of stories share them, write them down. Every single generation needs to retell them, and every storyteller retells the stories in a way that's unique to them, mm-hmm. That echoes with their concerns and their identity, and that kind of stuff is beautiful, and we have to just keep that going. So for all the would-be authors and folklorists who are listening, keep doing that sacred, beautiful work, and I will be looking forward to reading some of it. So thanks a lot.
Awesome. Again, thank you so much for your time. I know that you're very busy, so thank you for being here.
It was really a delight. Thank you so much.
All right, and we'll talk to you later.
Y'all, I loved that so much. I said it before the episode started, but again, David Bowles is absolutely one of those people that I feel like I could just ask one question and he had like the answers for the next three questions in his answer. I'm not going to do the typical like diving into the context for this episode, because again, David did a really, really great job of explaining what a lot of the context was for whatever he was talking about. I really, really recommend that you all pick up one of his books. Any of them would be really great. He mentioned in the end where you can find him, but you can also check out the website davidbowles.us. There's a tab on here for the books that he's written. There's a good few of them, actually. It's a long list here that I'm looking at. And so yeah, I really recommend picking up some of his works and reading them. They're kid-friendly, they're still entertaining for adults, and they're really beautiful pieces of work that you can read and share. So I really recommend that. I'm really excited for the rest of this Halloween season. We have two more episodes for this. I have some ideas of what I want to do, and I'm trying to make them really special. And yeah, I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and I hope that you enjoy the ones that are going to come out next. As always, please make sure that you follow the Instagram for any and all updates on the show at Susto Podcast. And if you have any of your own scary or paranormal or weird stories that you want to share with me and that you want me to read on the show, you can do that by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And in the review, leave your story. If you don't have iTunes, you can send me an email to sustopodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM me. And like I said earlier, you can post your story on the Susto Facebook as well. I'm trying to branch out as much as I can to reach as many people and give as many people the opportunity to not only hear the show, but also share their stories. I really, really want to share you all stories. So make sure that you spread the word, you follow the pages, and you leave all the reviews. I'm really grateful for all the support. I keep on looking at the analytics for the show, and I'm discovering like all this really cool stuff about like who listens to the show and how they listen to it. And so it's really neat to see that. And with that, I will leave that there, and I will talk to you all next time. Bye.